Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shopjack Show, a podcast all about front-end web design, full-stack, jam-stack development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey! Another day. We're going to have start having guests again, but we're so, there's like, you know, we only have so much bandwidth for certain things at a time, and we're still redesigning the site. So there's some stuff going on there. I was just working on it, Dave, just doing some fun little bits there. In fact, I moved the, you know, sometimes, you know, during a development time like this, you like rewrite something and then you rewrite it again. Sorry. I rewrote the jobs, you know, Dave had like took it off jQuery and put it on, and then I took it into just PHP. So, because, you know, I was doing that on some other site and it works really good. So I'm like, why do this client side when you can do it server side? So it makes a curl for the JSON file and throws it in a WordPress transient, you know, which is like really efficient. So it will only ever make that curl call, you know, once every couple days, you know.
That's like, is that WordPress's like native caching
it
kind
is.
Of?
Or yeah. Like, and it's tremendously cool. Easy to use. Dave is like, 7 lines of code or something to do the whole thing. It was great, you know?
So you do a curl and you're not just hammering the CodePen servers for jobs. So that's great.
Yeah, you wouldn't do that. In fact, we had a question about that on this show, like either last week, week before, something like that. Somebody's like, I want to make, you know, I can't remember the nature of the question, but it was a server side request for an API's information come back was required to have that page return at all. Which is like a terrible bad practice, you know.
They're getting like that white screen, right? Like that it was like, you know, full error, like PHP crashing because the API went down.
So. Yeah. You know, like when we, you know, when people talk about web performance, you know, there's so much nuance to it. It really is its like own career these days almost. But there's some kind of like fundamental truths to it all that you can always kind of, you know, like reduce requests and gzip stuff and whatever. But one of the, you know, like the root of it all is that very first document has to make it back at all for web performance to even start doing all the fancy other stuff that it's about to do. The browser needs that first chunk of HTML to start doing anything at all. So that's the first thing that you should look at. Like, how fast is that coming back? And on some nights, it's like 2 seconds. 2 seconds is awful. You want it to be like 2 milliseconds, like it's never going to be that fast. But if you can get it into the like low hundreds of milliseconds for that first document, that's good.
Well, and the thing I've been thinking about is, you know, a server to server communication, like that's milliseconds. You're in the 40 milliseconds for a server to ask another server for something. But the second you go to a radio tower client side, like on a cell phone or whatever, like now you're in the seconds, like multiple seconds, like minimum 400 millisecond round trip. And so like so if we can do whatever on the server, that's great. Saves so much time,
especially like on its own network. If you're like your server is talking to another one of your servers that are right next to each other, that's fine. You can generally fine. That's how databases work and all that.
Yeah,
but there's, you know, I remember an experiment, you know, with WordPress, you know, like let's split up. I thought, did this happen to me? God, I can't remember how this went down, but somebody's like, you know, like you might break up a website into different services. You might be like, my web server is on this server. My database is on this server. My APIs are on these cloud functions, whatever. And I took a WordPress database and put it on another just to split it up, just so that the one server wasn't doing all the work. And then my bill just skyrocketed because it was being charged for like off network transfer of data,
like traffic, like bandwidth traffic.
Yeah, it was bandwidth that was being measured because it was not in the same like network of stuff. Anyway, it just wasn't that much of an improvement anyway. But you kind of get why people do that. They're like, I want to split all my services up into individual bits and bobs so that they're responsible for less, and you don't get the noisy neighbor syndrome and all that stuff.
You know, that's something to consider, you know, about Jamstack stuff. I mean, I'm sure like Contentful and all these services kind of expect you to sort of hammer it or whatever, but you do have a bandwidth bill to sort of think about. I guess if I was doing my own headless thing or something like that, you know?
So yeah.
That's something that I haven't, you know.
There's just something that feels limitation. Like on the, you know, when you ask for data on the client side from an API as you load your page, sometimes that doesn't feel great. You know, you're like, you know, like I'm loading the page, but it doesn't have what it needs. It has to make a call to do it. But that's just, it's starting to be very commonplace. But it feels like, you know, like really especially bad to do it on the back end for every request to like ask, especially an off network API. Don't delay that first page load. You know, that's part of Jamstack, you know, that's like, I don't know. People don't talk about it in those terms usually, but it is a big deal. You know, when that document comes back in those like low hundreds of milliseconds, the base of really good performance is already there. So the temptation is just to like keep it that fast. Like, don't screw it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I would wonder what the point is where, let's say I delivered a fast document and JavaScript, and then I go fetch content or whatever. Like, there's got to be a point where you could move some of that content to the document and make the document bigger and bigger and bigger to where it's actually slower than like fetching with the JavaScript. If that makes sense, like the pre-render could actually be slower than the JavaScript fetch. Like, depending on how much content, I'd be curious to know what that number is in megabytes or whatever. But I think, but I don't know. Wasn't it Zach Leatherman tweeted out like his 8 meg Twitter archive loaded faster than one React?
Oh, that was absolutely hilarious. Yeah. I can load all my tweets faster than one tweet.
Just
That's absolutely nuts.
I think we need to get him back on actually, because we never finished his manifesto. But I think he had said either behind the scenes or during his talk at Jamstack Conf last year that, you know, it was maybe like there was a little bit of unfairness in the test or something like that, like network or versus localhost or something. But
There was one little caveat, but I can't remember what it was. You know, I linked to the this post from Hugo the other day that feels relevant to this. Like, let's say you're going to, you know, you want to build a front end with like GraphQL. So you're going to use like Vue, and then you're going to, you know, use Vuex for all your states, and you're going to populate all your data by hitting a GraphQL endpoint, you know, have like an Apollo server thing going on. Like, that's like as fancy as it gets front end wise these days, right? That's like exotic front end development. That's not exotic in a rare sense, but like this, people aren't doing things much fancier than that. That's like leveraging all the latest, greatest, cool stuff. So when you're there on that edge, you know, unfortunately through time, server side rendering hasn't been a strong part of that story. None of these frameworks, even Vue, wasn't like, we're going to be SSR first and then other stuff. You know, none of these JavaScript libraries are like SSR first, you know. It's a little unfortunate, but you can get it done, you know. So like, let's say you have a button and you click that button and it fires off a GraphQL mutation and increments a like or something. That's like a pretty difficult situation for progressive enhancement too. Like, if you wanted to SSR that, chances are SSR is just going to like put the button there, but it's not actually going to be like ready to use. But that's why I enjoyed this post from Hugo about Apollo GraphQL without JavaScript. Even it can be done, because if you're, first of all, you got to get SSR going, because whatever, then that's that. But then if for every little button and interactive element like that, you can wrap it in a form tag, and the form has an action attribute that links to your GraphQL endpoint that does the mutation, you know? So it's fine if it like hydrates up or whatever. I don't know. I don't even know. Maybe you don't even need it at that point. But, you know, that's the only way a button works in HTML. Like, the only way you can get up to post some data, you have to wrap it in a form. That's like the only thing. I guess it could be an anchor tag with a GET request, but that's not. Then it like changes the URL all nasty. And
no, this is, I saw this post and they did it's clever. It's, hey, I'll just make a form that then enhances up to, and it's all in React. It's clever. I mean, it's just
the idea. You just don't see people doing that very often. I bet he's like one of the few in the world that picked these really fancy new exotics and then took the trouble to progressively enhance all the way down to even a button press, you know? Pretty cool.
Really clever. No, I mean, I wouldn't have gotten here. So it's
no, I'd mean? Be like, ah, oh, this is possible, but like, I'm a little busy. So nah.
Yeah. So, but you know, I think we had talked about, what was it last week? Alpine JS, which, you know, once we talked about it, now it's like in my feed. I don't know if Twitter can listen to podcasts or whatever, but now it's in my feed. And people are doing cool stuff with it. I think it's neat. And then a few people linked out. Sorry, I don't have the links here, but I know some people had mentioned like, here's some like alternatives that are very similar and stuff like that. I forget them offhand, but thank you for sending those links. It's always cool to check out. But yeah, it's Alpine maybe is not like a progressive enhancement framework per se, but it's very much, I feel like when you have those like HTML directives or you start with HTML, sort of like how Hugo started with a
form. At least you're, right? You have the possibility is closer. Yeah.
Yeah. The delta of like getting there is smaller. So,
that's what I like about Vue inline templates, right? That's like that is a core feature of Vue. So it's, while Vue isn't necessarily like SSR first or something, it kind of is, because it's kind of like, well, it can just work on your regular HTML. So if you want SSR, then do it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's interesting. I'm trying to think. You know, have you been following all this kind of design systemy speak that's going around? It's very interesting, and it's got my
pretty
brain.
Pretty vague. Tell me.
There's been, so Jeremy Keith wrote an article.
Oh, I read this one about, it's like architecture versus gardening kind of deal.
Yeah, architecture versus gardening, and man, that's really like standing out in my brain, and because it's been something that I've been thinking about, and I'm like working on a blog post right now. Who knows if it'll be out either today, if I just obsess over it, or it'll be out in 5 weeks after this podcast. But it's, you know, it's really, it's interesting. And then you put in, you know, you kind of factor in things like Ethan Marcotte wrote the hoof and the horse, you know, which was a riff on Robin Rendell's systems mistakes in the sea, which is really good. There's, and then even in Ethan's talk, he references, Gina's Ann's, there is no design system post on 24 ways, which was good. Where it's kind of like pulling design systems away from like being an artifact more as like a methodology, which is something to think about too. Like it's not, you know, it's not this bucket of components so much as like, here's how we build things, which is, it probably gets back to what Brad Frost did, you know, was even kind of getting at, you know, this, we just need to build things in this way. This is how things build up, you know? But then it becomes systematized and then it becomes industrialized. And then it's very interesting to me. That's all I wanted to say.
You know, I don't have a single design pattern, a single design system in production of all the sites, all of them. Hmm. I write some HTML, I write some CSS, I write some JavaScript, I ship the website. It's not that things aren't built in components, because they kind of are, but they're not particularly prescriptive. There's no storybook, there's no pattern lab, it's no fractal. Like I've dipped my toes in all of those tools, and it felt a little bit more like gardening, I guess. Like we already have these things, so let's just chuck them in here so that we can like look at them like a zoo. Like, look, there's some patterns there. Look, kids, the zebra is eating the grass.
Well, I think that's a really good point. Like, you know, I think sometimes design systems are a zoo and you need a zoo. Like, how else are you going to teach kids about what kind of animals are in the website? You know, like here's the kind of animals we have, and we divided them up into little zones. Now you know these are the marketing-y animals, you know? So I think a zookeeper is a really excellent analogy as well. It just, you know, I think design systems as documentation machines are great, especially as teams get bigger or, demands get bigger.
Yeah, the Teams thing is a big deal. And I didn't say what I said to say that design systems are bad. It's just I feel like my teams are small enough that it's not, the time commitment isn't as useful. We're not like building something and shipping it to somebody else who's going to consume it, for example. I think that's a part of it. But if we were going to onboard three designers and they started just on day one, they're like cranking out code. If they didn't have a zoo to look at what's already there, that would be, the chances are good that bad things are going to happen. You know, they're just going to reinvent a bunch of components and kind of get into that messy state that we've been trying to fight against. So maybe the zoo is nice to that, even though there's no like, there's just a zookeeper, not like a zoo master. It's like, you right. can only use these patterns. I am the master, you know, anything else shall not be. But the zookeeper is just like, come one, come all, look at the elephants. They're over here.
Look, I'm going to put my head in the tiger's mouth. I think you had, well, if you like CodePen is very, you know, it's, you're very, it's a smaller organization, but it's very like y'all still write code. But if there were three, four levels of management in between the owners of the company and the people who write the code, well, I think the value goes up too. And I'm talking, even if you had the same number of programmers and designers, like the value would go up if there was like 4x the number of managers now dictating what, you know, has to go in the website tomorrow. You know, I think the value of a design system goes up there too, because it's like, you know, like a manager is going to be like, we need a rabbit with antlers. And you're like, great. I'll just go look at the rabbits and then go look at an animal with the antlers and I'll smash them together. That I did it. You know, I made it a new animal. So you just kind of, we're like, okay, where can we find examples of animals? Anyway, I'm losing the zookeeper analogy now, but I feel like having that zoo, that sort of, here, look at all everything we have. This is what we know about the world. I feel like the knowledge documentation aspect of design systems is great, but I think like what you said, like if it becomes like you can only use, like we have a squirrel and a penguin, and those are your only choices, you'd be like, I think I need something different. You know?
So we're saying I'll the zoo use. is the gardening analogy, and the like the zoo master ruler is the architect analogy. We just made a new analogy, which the world probably didn't need, but
the But you know, to the idea of like a zoo master, like you know the one job that design systems do well is reduce the number of decisions that have to be made. You know, so you got like team A and team B, they built five different accordions. Two teams will produce five accordions. And why did that happen? Well, just whatever, staffing, turnover, no one knowing, you know, it happens. So I've removed five accordions from a site last year. So there you go. Like, why does that happen? It just does.
This episode of Shop Doc Show is brought to you by Clubhouse. Clubhouse is a fast and enjoyable project management platform that breaks down silos and brings teams together to ship value, not features. Let's face it, slow, confusing UX is so last decade. Clubhouse is lightning fast, built for today's software teams with only the features and best practices you need to succeed and nothing more. Here are a few highlights about Clubhouse. Flexible workflows. You can easily customize workflow states for teams or projects of any size. Advanced filtering. You can quickly filter by project or team to see how everything is progressing. There's sprint planning. Set your weekly priorities with iterations and let Clubhouse run the schedule for you. It also integrates with the tools you love. Clubhouse ties into your existing tools, services, and workflow. Get notifications or create a story in Slack, update the status of a story with a pull request, preview designs from Figma links, or build your own integration with the Clubhouse API and more. It also has enjoyable collaboration. Easy drag and drop UI, dark mode, emoji reactions, and more. When you're doing your best work and your team is clicking, life is good. Clubhouse has recently made all core features completely free for teams with up to 10 users. And they're offering listeners of Shop Talk Show 2 free months on any paid plan, with unlimited users and access to premium features. You can give it a try at clubhouse.io/shoptalk. Thanks again to Clubhouse for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Fantastic. Well, that was a fun way to start. I like just talking about whatever kind of is on our minds and has come up in the news lately. We got a question here from Alex, who's wondering about equipment, basically. So he said his company provided him a MacBook Air, which he likes.
Okay.
And plenty sufficient for him to do front-end development, he's saying. And he got a chair, nice chair, and a desk. And then he's like, okay, well, what else should I ask for, though? Like, I'm starting this new job. Like, should I ask for a couple monitors? You know, like, what about a standing desk? Like, my desk is okay, but it's not standing. And I would also like a wireless mouse, a beanbag chair, and a rubber duck. You know, so I think Alex is feeling like,
yeah,
at what point is it, like, do I just keep asking until they say no? Like, what's reasonable these days? I mean, we both work for ourselves, kind of, so it's hard to know, but I wonder what you get if you like go to work at Twitter right now. Do you get all that?
I think you get the laptop and maybe a desktop monitor and a pair of headphones, I think is what you get.
Ooh, you get headphones.
Well, because you sit in an open office and they want you to actually work.
So yeah.
You get noise canceling headphones.
The irony of the open office. It's supposed to be like, oh, it's so great. Everybody talks to each other, but really it's just cheaper.
It's collaboration, and you occupy 0.75% of the space that you normally would. But I think for me, what I would ask for, like, maybe this is because, I mean, whatever, we're chumps, and I feel like I will buy it if I want it. Or like I have these weird rules about money. But I'm like, if it helps me work, like I'm pretty sure, like, I've done the research and I can like quantify that it would probably help me work, then I'll just purchase it, you know? Mm-hmm. For me, like, there's four things I'll say I need. I need an ergonomic mouse. I need an ergonomic keyboard. I like ultra wide displays because it lets me work on one screen without a bunch of window switching. I do a bunch of window switching, but it has the real estate I need. Mm-hmm. An ultra wide display, and then a standing desk as well. Like, and then I'm going to put a good chair in there probably some good headphones. I got six things now, but I need those things. Like I literally need the standing desk. Like, doctors have said, like, oh, you sit too much and that's why your back sucks. Like, that I need. I feel way more productive on an ultra wide display. I have two displays.
I'll take
right
that
now.
One. I have two of the LG 5Ks, and I'm eyeing up the fancy Apple one. Although I choke looking at the price, so I can't. I don't think I can pull the trigger on that. So it's incredible. It was way too expensive. But sometimes I work from home, and at home I have one of those ultra wides, and I prefer it. It's not even Retina, so sometimes I like get a little bummed out looking at it because I can dramatically tell the difference, and it's kind of janky. And it's such a cheap one that if you have like a browser window in the middle of it and you scroll it, you can see the split as it scrolls up and down where the two monitors are like stitched together, basically.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's tough. But I prefer the shape of it so much that I'm tempted to go back down to one. So I feel you, man. One monitor is where it's at.
Yeah, you know, and that Apple one might be a good choice, but because it's a little wider aspect than the standard cinema display. But
$5,000 and a $1,000 freaking stand.
Hey, for $5,000, we could put you into this puppy. But if you think about it, like, you know, how much are you going to use it?
You're gonna Oh, my God, Dave, do not convince me to do this. I'll kill you.
Well, hey, and then think how beautiful your screenshots will be for your marketing.
What convinced me not to do it, I was just about to pull the trigger, was that even Apple touts it as not really just for average people. It's what they call a reference monitor, right? For like, for people doing incredible, you know, movie work that have these otherwise like $20,000 monitors where like, you know, black is black and color is exactly as it is on tape. Like, I don't know. I guess I get the term reference monitor because it's like exactly what you have as information is what's shown on this thing. And so they're really expensive. And this is Apple's play at like combating that market. Be like, look at ours. It's amazing too. And a quarter of the price kind of thing. So it's like not for me. It's not designed for me.
It's not for you.
But it kind of is. you know, it's just a nice monitor.
I will say LG has 4K displays.
Yeah.
And they're kind of ultra wide-ish, like a little bit of a wider aspect. So that might be something to check out if you're interested in that. I don't know.
So they're good pixel density or whatever. Do we still say retina? Is that still a thing we say?
4K UHD and they have a 5K IPS. IPS is a pretty good panel, but it has bad ratings. So I don't know. I wouldn't maybe do that one. Mm-hmm. That's for it. But, you know, I think you want a little bit wide, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it does seem like it's more for, like, I don't know, video production artists and stuff like that.
I wish it was a little wider and a little less tall.
Mm-hmm.
Can I get like 3 working spaces on it? I usually am like a 2 kind of guy anyway, but like it's a little too, I don't know. Who cares? Okay. That was quite the aside. Yeah. So for Alex, I don't know. Yeah, I would. I don't know. You work at a company. Just if you need some stuff, ask for it and see what they say. You know, I mean, it sounds like they're kind of hooking you up already. So that's kind of good. Hey, did you ever work for a client where they give you a laptop because that's what they want you to work on?
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. I mean, it's fine. It's just terrible. I think I've had 2 situations. You know, it was just like for network security reasons, I needed to use this client's laptop and, you know, and then I'm juggling laptops, all my personal stuff's on one and all my work stuff's on the other. And like, it's like, okay, cool. You know, and then I think when I did the Microsoft back in site in 2012, they made us do I had to get like a Windows 8 machine with like a little chip reader to like go in and, you know, so that was kind of a bit of a burden because not only was it just not only was it like a new platform, but then there's all this different security model stuff and all that. So that was difficult, but
it's pretty common though. I think you hire somebody to do some work for you and it's an unreasonable expectation to be like, oh, also have a really high end laptop that we won't support. You know, that's a little funny.
Yeah.
So we at CodePen, we buy all of our employees laptops. And as far as I know, they all use them. You know, because it's, which is, I think, totally reasonable and cool. I don't know how many of them have a separate laptop for their home stuff. I was always a weirdo in that every job I worked at, I wouldn't allow it. I was like, I don't want your laptop. I just want one. And I want it to have all my stuff on this one thing.
And I think my issue, I have a desktop PC and a laptop, you know, like that I carry around and stuff like that. And I'm maybe when I'm building a new office and stuff, I'll maybe set up 2 desks, to be honest. And I might have like a gaming machine that has one monitor. And then I might have another, like, just a plug-in laptop that has an ultra wide. I think that's honestly where I'm headed. So, but I haven't quite decided yet. But.
I remember going to Estelle Wiles' house one time. She had like a stack of like 5 MacBooks in there because she did some consulting work and each different consulting gig gave her a laptop.
Yeah. So like, what does she do? But then
I didn't blame, you know, I was like, that sounds like a nightmare to me, but it's like, if they support the machine, like, so you pick up that laptop, all you're doing is that job on that laptop, you know, still sounds a little nightmare-y to me, but I get why.
You know? Yeah. No, I get it. Do you, sorry, this might be too personal, but if somebody quits or leaves CodePen, do you ask for the laptop back or is it kind of a gift?
No,
yeah. Cause it's, well, in tax wise, like it's just weird how it works, right? It's like, oh, you're going to depreciate that asset over the next 30 years or what? 5 years, you know? And so like, you can't just, anyway.
Sometimes somebody else, sometimes when things like that happen, it's like you kind of need it for something else. You'd be like, well, I could use a new one, so why don't I take that one back, take that and take my new one and give it to this person. And usually it sets off a little chain reaction of laptop shuffling. Like,
it's like a hot laptop sort of.
All right. So here's one from Jackson.
Yeah. Jackson writes in, I recently taken the position of the sole in-house developer for an otherwise non-technical team that has a bespoke web platform as one of its central products. The previous work was done by consultants and they managed to get everything off the ground, making money. They cut some corners hard-coded plenty of business logic dependent on specific database records existing and followed other similar poor practices. The product is in pretty brittle condition. Mm. I really want to introduce some testing to the code base for the sake of my sanity, but I don't know where to start. It's essentially two pieces, a Laravel API and a React front end. What I want to do is ensure the changes to the API or the front end won't break production.
Yeah, this was a longer question that I truncated a bit, but the deal is, you know, like sometimes a change will happen and it'll just break production. But so break is what I wanted to hone in on, because like break how exactly? Does it 500 or does it like render a, does React try to render and fail because it like is missing data or some kind of weird JavaScript error happens? Because they're kind of different things. It's a little easier to test a 500 than it is a client-side error, you know? You don't have to spin up a browser to know about a 500, you know?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, not for... Well, I've been starting some projects or whatever, and, you know, when you name a field, you're like thing.title, and then the other thing, you're like, oh, thing.name, you know, thing2.name, and thing1.title, and you're like, oh, man, I should make those the same. I just wasn't paying attention, you know, but I've already put the code in production, so what do I do, you know? Mm. And I've always, like, wondered, especially in a very client-side framework heavy thing, how do you do this migration? I guess you'd have to like update the database, duplicate the fields, update the backend, make sure you're writing to both fields at the same time, right?
Yeah.
And then ship the front end with the new, you know, okay, now it's all dot title for the here on out, and then go through and delete the, you know, logic in the CMS, and then go delete the logic in the, or go delete the field in the table. And I'm just, I was like, man, that is a lot of effort. Cause, or do people just try to ship these things both at the same time, like a database migration and a, like, mm-hmm. I was even thinking like, what if you accidentally, you know, I spelled password wrong in the MySQL or whatever, like it's password. Ugh. And I was like, oh, I need to fix password. You know, how do I fix this with like minimal downtime? You know, like, I guess you like can,
I don't know. You put it in the API first, I guess, or gosh, I don't know. That's a tricky one. Cause right? There's three layers now that you need to work on. There's the database and the API and the consumer of that API.
Right.
I mean, there's some, you know, GraphQL handles some of this, you know, at the API level, you leave title alone and put name in. They're just both there. And then the consumer can just start using the new one, and then the docs or whatever you say, you know, title is deprecated. Don't use title, but it's still here, so it's not going to break stuff.
Sure.
And then, you do what you need to do on the server side. And it's like less my forte, but yeah, that's why they say, you know, GraphQL APIs don't need to be versioned, because you can just add stuff.
Add fields. Yes. Yeah. They can be, they don't. Yeah. I guess
it's not totally true. Cause you like, how long do you leave old crap in there? You know, then because who knows who comes along and starts using old crap, you know, then you're like, well, come on, I'm not versioning, but I'm just expanding the surface area of what I need to support, which can be just as bad.
Well, and it's fine if it's whatever blog post dot title and blog post dot name or heading or whatever you did wrong. That's fine. But if it's blog post dot body, now your response and blog post dot description or something like that, like your response is going to be huge, you know? Depending on, anyway, back to this question from Jackson, how do you test it? This is a, I don't know.
Remember I talked about my dream testing service. I totally want to build this. It's like all y'all have all your fancy tests. My service has nothing fancy at all. You put a list of URLs in there and all we do is tell you if it threw a hard error or threw a JavaScript error, and that's it. Because I feel like, you know, there was a CSS Wizardry, a Harry post the other day about performance testing and how pragmatic it probably should be to start. Whereas it's the temptation is to put together a very fancy budget and have it testing and CI and blah, 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 blah. He's like, I don't know. That's like, you know, almost like next level stuff. You know, the easiest thing to do is just measure what you're doing now and set up an alert if it gets any worse. With like automated tool, that way it just protects you from screwing up really bad. You know, I feel like that's the baby step into test too. just be like, I don't know, did a page like totally bomb on production? Write one test that prevents that thing from happening, and that's your testing framework now. You just
sort of reactive, or I guess responsive.
Yeah, you can go out a little ahead too, but what testing isn't is like, well, we have 350 JavaScript functions in here and only half of them are pure, and so I guess let's start chipping away at writing tests for all these functions. It's like, no, dude, just run an integration test. And that's easy because there's all kinds of them these days. There's Cypress is the big super easy one because it has their fancy mm-hmm. front end, but we've been playing with just Puppeteer at CodePen. It's just Puppeteer spins up Chrome so super duper duper fast, you know, and headless too. And then you write these little tests that are just like, visit this URL, await, click this button, await, did this happen, you know, and all that clicky testy stuff is fine too. Like I like those tests, but if all the test was is visit this URL, that's cool too, because it's implied test that URL spins up okay. Like if something's wrong, mm-hmm. the test is going to fail. So like, I just think testing can be so easy.
Right? Like, yeah, no, I think I like your ideas. Like you almost need layers, right? Of major mess ups, like major problems. Okay. Then test quality, and then like, or I guess, what would it, reliability,
yeah,
robustness, and something else?
What made me think of this is that Jackson's just like, it's really brittle. It's really brittle, so one little change can destroy all of production. Well, that's the test you write then. Write the test that just checks if total destruction has happened. Not the little mm-hmm. nuanced thing that caused the destruction. Just test if the destruction happened.
Yeah. Well, and he says he's working on an API. I mean, I wasn't Rachel Andrew. I don't know if this is in a private chat I'm sharing with the world, but she was kind of describing like, I have, you know, like an API, but like we need to make sure it has certain responses. So how, like, and she was asking for help, like how people do that. I felt like she got a good answer, but I can't remember what it was, but the, you know, I think it's possible to test an API and just say like, I need to have this A, B, and C back in the response. And that should help your React app too. It's maybe not traditional, I guess, unit testing or of functions,
that's,
you know,
a little closer to integration testing than unit testing. Cause you have to hit some URL, right, to get it. So,
yeah, but that could be, I mean,
it could be either way,
write your own in some ways, you know, like, or adjusting, like, it expects whatever, fetch foo from bar or whatever, fetch foo then response.json or whatever to equal, you know, or to exist or whatever. And then that's a good sign that it's going to work. You know, your React front end, that's got different way to test that code. I don't do a lot of that, so I can't really attest to it, but just, I guess, with React testing framework. But, you know, I think you're going to have to really QA the API, and that's probably writing kind of this weird layer of just test that fetch from the API, like fetch things. And
yeah, that's going to help you a lot. If there's a lot of API stuff, you're right. And then you could write that. I'm sure there's a way to do that in one of the, what are the Mocha and Jest. And there's a whole list of them, you know, that are just like little node-based things. You'll probably have to pull in some Axios kind of deal, or I don't know, is fetch in node now? I guess it is, right? If you're using a newest
node fetch, yeah.
You're using fetch the JSON, look at the JSON, is the stuff in the JSON that you expect? Yeah. I'd freaking run that one on a cron, dude. Run it every hour.
Run it every hour.
Yeah.
Now you're into serverless territory there. No, yeah, I think that could work. Yeah, it's tough though, and like I've been in those where you jump into a database and you're just like, what were people doing? You know, like why is this? Why is that? Like, you know, it was one that, you know, it was like a thing where like people, I had to like get or like VPN into some server to get the config file, like the latest config. People just ship config changes to like some to the system, or they'd like just write them directly into the VPN, like the test server or whatever. And it was just like, dude, what? Like, that's why my thing hasn't been working all day. Cause I had to like go like VPN into some server, you know, some IP to like get a file. Like there's a lot of substandard situations out there. And I apologize, but I it is people just trying to get their job done, I think, unfortunately. So there you go. If it works, people don't want to touch it. But hopefully, if you're the like sole in-house developer, you should have a little bit of leeway, I would hope. So hopefully that'll work out for you without breaking things too much.
You know, I will say too that I find integration tests easier to write these days because the frameworks have gotten so good around them and so accessible. I think that that's not particularly hard. So check out those. You know, no, I'm not even going to go there, but visual regressing testing is nice too, you know, like I think that one's important because that's a form of an integration test too. If you spin up a visual regressing testing tool and it loads your homepage and it's a blank white page, well, you've proved that that blew up stuff too, and you can prevent that from deploying. So anything that's high level like that can be so valuable for so little.
Yeah. It's not going to save you, you know, it sounds silly, and maybe this is going to blow our safe for work title, but I start thinking of like testing and automated tools like this as more like a prophylactic than something that's going to save you. It's something that's like helping you practice safe development. And that's where I'm going to stop it there before it gets too, don't go too far on this analogy. But it helps you have a safer development experience and gives you some guidelines. And hopefully things don't go as wrong as they could. So that's, I hope that happens. So consider it that way. It's just a way to do things a little bit safer than usual.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by AWS Amplify. You know AWS, right? Amazon Web Services. It powers most of the internet, it feels like. There's a ton of things that go in the AWS bucket, like EC2 allows you to like spin up servers of your choice and has all kinds of configuration. And like S3 is for file storage and Lambdas is for running cloud functions, all kinds of stuff that individually you can set up and use and are great. But there's so much more than that. You know, there's a ton of different things AWS does. AWS Amplify is kind of a package of tools to help you build full stack apps for the web. So it's like, I don't know, just give me the stuff that I need that usually you need to build an app. So Amplify is hosting. You need web hosting, it's got that. It's got authentication for logins for your users. It's got GraphQL as a first-class citizen of it. It's got serverless functions, like I need, you know, the Lambda thing. I want to run some code in the cloud to hit APIs and do whatever else I need to. And it's got file storage if you need it. It's got some machine learning stuff in there if you need it. So Amplify is this, you know, easy to use full stack framework for getting started quick with building web apps. Is really cool. The auth stuff alone is cool. It's just a few lines of code in there. GraphQL has taken over the world of how to get things from a database, put things back in a database, really front end development friendly way to do database stuff. Love GraphQL. It's just built in as a first class citizen. It's the scalable API. It just, you don't have to provision your own servers. It just does it up for you. Pretty cool. So AWS Amplify is really cool. Definitely worth checking out, especially as a front-end developer. So check all that out.
Next question.
Yeah. Shelton Clinard is a... He heard you were messing around with IntelliJ and got excited. He's a big PHP Storm, WebStorm user. I'd like to hear more about your experience with that. I'm always intrigued by these things too, because they're like so many people use free editors, me included, VS Code. And I just sometimes stare at VS Code with my jaw gaped, you know, not the most beautiful editor in the world, but holy crap, does it do its job. Just amazing. But, you know, I remember when the Kraft guys worked here in the office, they all used PHP Storm, you know, because all they do is all write PHP all day. And in the promise, I think the main one is that when you use an editor like that, that's like specialized for a language, that it like knows how to run it. It's almost like low key running your code while you're writing it to see about problems and stuff in a way that VS Code just totally does not do that. It might have some heuristic stuff it can do, but it's not like executing PHP, you know?
Yeah. Like it was, you know, it was an experience. I'll say that. Like, I was using IntelliJ. A client had a Java project, Java and Spring.
Was it the same deal? Does it like execute the Java to tell you what's up?
Yeah. I mean, and everything's in there, you know, so you have to kind of set up some configs, you know, it's sort of, you know, and I think in web development, right, you maybe have a Docker container if you're lucky, but you know, you kind of just like, okay, let's hope that this stuff is here. Right. Java isn't there for sure. And there's different Javas, right? So you have to go in and set up, I want to use this java.exe or whatever, you know, dot is a binary of some kind. And you say, and then for my server, I want you to point to this instance of Tomcat, which is, you know, and that was sort of the, I'm sure there's other servers and stuff like that. And then in the Java ecosystem, there's also Maven, right? And then, you know, once it's like, oh, you have Maven, a little Maven panel shows up and is like, click the thing and Maven's like a task runner, basically, sort of like Grunt, but XML based, which is sweet. So then you click on the thing you want to run. You want to clean the project, you click clean. You want to like mount or like start the server, you click start or whatever. Like that's how it goes. And then when you click start, like your console pops, it's like it detects like,
yeah,
oh, you started the server. Now the console just pops up automatically and like you start seeing all the binaries compiling and transferring, and then you get line errors per like, oh, like the whatever, you had a bad type on this Java file in this, you know, something. So you just like click through and then you're on there. And, you know, so it has ergonomically, it is maybe not for me, but it is powerful. And I think if you are like a all PHP shop and an all IntelliJ or a Java shop, like these tools are actually pretty good and maybe indispensable. Me personally,
can you imagine working in that environment for 5 years and then taking some new job where it wasn't there anymore? You'd be like, what is what?
Oh, and all your muscle memory, yeah. Like, you know, it was like, I forget what the search one, like, you know how you search for files, command shift P or control shift P, mm-hmm. or whatever. You know, in IntelliJ, it's like shift shift, like you type shift shift or something like that. And then that like, oh, okay. Like that goes, that's how you find things. And it took me a long time to like figure all this stuff out. But eventually, you know, you figure that out.
That one's such a big one. In fact, I've been on the Nova, which is like Coda 3 from Panic, yeah, which is irrelevant to you because it will never be Windows, but still it's, you know, it's industry news anyway. And I was like, you know, I'll give it the only way you ever can really do it is if you just actually try to switch, you know, like open your actual projects in it and use it. I found I think they're asking people not to give like straight up reviews of the software yet, because it's like, it's not freaking ready. It's beta. So I won't say too much about the experience of using it, other than to allude to that, like, you know, like, I don't know, like, you know, exactly what you expect. It's like better than you think it's going to be, but there's little things, you know. And one of the things was, which they just, my muscle memory, it turns out the number one command I use in text editors is that like jump to file thing, you know, like whatever it is. It was command T, I think, in Sublime. And then I VS Code. Depends on if you map it in the same way or not. But I don't traverse folders to get to files ever.
Right. So if you're missing that, that's huge.
And they totally have like, that. This but it's sucks. Just a different.
That triggers like, this sucks in my brain.
It does.
Even though it's like, some weird thing I learned from some other weird software.
Right. And that's just one command. And if you're all in on IntelliJ, then you're going to have the hardest time in the world switching off of it because it's doing so much for you. And then it turns out that in there, you can customize the triggers in a really nice way. So I was able to remap it just fine and it worked great. So it's like, it's sweet, you know? But it's not in the IntelliJ category either, you know? These editors that are like language specific are like next level stuff.
Well, and I think I've said it before, but you know, in 2012 when I worked on the Microsoft site, like, you know, I had to write in code or Visual Studio, not even code. Yeah. That didn't exist yet. So Visual Studio proper, big boy edition. And it had, you know, and I'm just, my brain is like in overload. I'm just like, what is going on? How do I find things? There's what are projects? What's a, you know, like, or it just, you know, I disliked it quite a bit, you know? And then, you know, every time I hit save, I watched the compiler spin up and I just was like, this is the worst way to do web development. And lo and behold, you know, 8 years later, I was sitting waiting around on compilers all the time. Like that's just how you do web development now. And I'm eating my hat, you know, but then looking back, you know, inside Visual Studio Code, there was this Team Foundation server and that's where my bug tickets were. And I was like, this thing's so stupid. User stories, blah, blah, blah. It's like, guess what? I'm just using user stories. And wouldn't it be kind of handy if all my tickets were inside my freaking editor? Probably, because then I could just reference them or like commit files right in the editor. And guess what? That's what I do now in Visual Studio Code. Like I just commit in the editor and it's just fine. So
that's funny.
So I think there's a lot of like, whatever, high and mighty nerd sniping or whatever about editors and really it's I'm getting, and I probably was in that camp for sure, but it's so much about like find something that works good for you. I think a lot of people have a success, like, you know, either, you know, it's in some ways this is like bootstrap versus rolling your own, you know, design system. You know, some people just they want to start with the toolkit that has everything and use the parts they want. And some people want to start with nothing and build up to what works for them,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
And they may be missing out on features because they didn't Google well enough or whatever. But I feel like...
But you're almost, you know, safer at the
code,
bottom.
Sublime.
I'm not going to like judgment call either one, but the one that has everything, maybe they're just more productive right out of the gate. But the other one is like less fragile. Like if you start with nothing and only add a little stuff, that means you're like competent and can do your job like in just a notepad. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
And the big one costs thousands of dollars a year and the other one is free. So what do you want? Like, well, I mean,
that too.
You got to think about that. So I just, you know, I think you have a build your own and a kind of framework, the kit and caboodle, you know, and I think there's different people and they like different things. And, you know, but for me, I think I gravitate more towards the like build your own system. Although that's a pain in the ass. Have you ever tried to set up ESLint, StyleLint, and Prettier in one project? God help you. Like it's almost impossible. I think WestBoss gave up. All right. But like it's almost impossible.
I got that going. Hey, that's a requirement for me.
But it's difficult. It's a 2 days of work to get it all going. So, in some ways, you know, Shelton's like, I found the easy way out. I bought the big tool and it like does it for me. And I literally don't care. Like I just get to type into it and it'll even tell me what to type. And that's great. So anyway, hey, guess what? I have a hard stop literally in 1 minute. So we probably need to wrap up.
Yeah. Go quick. You got it.
Well, thanks everybody for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Starheart, favorite it up. Really, we do appreciate your listenership. We are having fun with this show this year, and we will be redesigning the website and launching that pretty soon. So bear with us on that. And then, follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show, tons of tweets. If you hate your job, shoptalkshow.com/jobs. It'll be even faster in the future.
Yeah.
Milliseconds. And then, Chris, you got anything else you'd like to see?
Boy, that's it for me. Shoptalkshow.com.